This episode of To The Journey is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international programme of the non-profit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hi, this is Robert Duncan McNeil, also known as Tom Paris from Star Trek Voyager. You're listening to Trek FM.
I think it's safe to say that no one on this crew has been more obsessed with getting home than I have. But when I think about everything we've been through together, maybe it's not the destination that matters. Maybe it's the journey. And if that journey takes a little longer, so we can do something we all believe in, I can't think of any place I'd rather be, or any people I'd rather be with.
To the journey.
You're here.
To the journey.
Hello, everybody at home, and welcome. This is To The Journey. I'm your co-host, Suzanne Williamson, and with me, as always, are...
Kay Shaw and...
Zachary Fruling.
Well, today we're going to be doing something a little bit different. In the Babel Conference, Charles Balser had a suggestion for us. Thank you, Charles. Thank you so much. It's an episode in defense of Threshold. And here's what I have to say about that. Please insert the sound of crickets chirping here. And that's all I have to say.
Suzanne, you can just call this an episode right now.
And we're done. Thank you.
There are things to like.
This is quite a challenge. We're going to defend the indefensible.
Yes.
Yes. Or at least attempt.
Yes. And we thought if we were defending the indefensible, the best way to start that would be with... I think what we can probably say is the most maligned episode of Voyager. Probably one of the most maligned episodes of Star Trek.
Yes.
No, it's like an apologia in the Greek sense, right? A defense.
Yeah.
Of this charge that Threshold corrupts the minds of anyone who watches it.
I'm not sure I've ever heard anyone put it quite like that, but...
Poisons your mind.
Yeah, I mean, I do think the whole episode gets written off quite easily, and there is some... Well, there's stuff to like in here.
So it's not totally the albatross that hangs around Voyager's neck?
No, I don't think so. I think, actually, overall, there are episodes of Voyager I enjoy watching less than this, definitely, even though, you know, some of it maybe isn't the best.
I honestly don't think I've rewatched Threshold in the last 5 years.
What? Yeah, it's been quite a long while.
We were supposed to watch it for this episode.
No, I did. Okay. I totally watched it for this episode. But before I rewatched it for this episode, I hadn't watched it in about 5 years because I just skip over it out of habit.
I agree. I think it had been quite a long while since I'd watched it.
Oh, definitely.
Before we watched it for this.
So I watched it today with fresh eyes. I have rediscovered the merits of Threshold.
Marvelous. Are you starting us off then?
Okay. There are some fabulous one-liners from the Doctor when he is... waking up Tom Paris in sick bay. Captain asks, can you wake him up? I don't see why not. Wake up, Lieutenant! That's funny.
I think she's expecting him to, like, do some kind of medical thing, isn't she?
Yeah, due to hypo spray or something.
Like, wake up!
He could have just pinched him at that point.
No, he is just asleep, not, like, in a coma sense.
I actually love that Captain Janeway finally just walks out of there, like, I'm done here. I can't do anything for him. I'm done. Okay, right off the bat, though, I gotta say, I love the concept that this episode starts out with.
Absolutely.
You know, because it's it's this thing in Star Trek that we understand that we don't talk about very much. Like warp 10, what exactly is that? Is it a speed that you just can't go past for practical reasons? But here we kind of get a little backstory on warp 10, right? It's a theoretical limit. Like you can approach it, but you can never actually achieve it. It's like an asymptote in mathematics. It's such a cool idea. Mm-hmm. And then what would it mean to achieve warp 10? Well, it's cool to flesh that idea out. Well, you'd be at every point in the universe simultaneously. That's a neat idea. And then to flesh out how you would illustrate that or show that visually or flesh out what that means. I think the episode actually starts out really strong with a good, interesting Star Trek-y concept.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with that. I think I really like the beginning. And like you say, you know, this is something that we've possibly danced around a little bit throughout the history of Star Trek. And I know people are probably going to say, oh, well, you know, in the original series, they got to warp 13 and all this type of thing. And I think the numbers aren't really important, but
they recalibrated the scale.
Yeah, exactly. So we won't worry too much about the numbers. But the idea of a theoretical warp limit is like a, you know, it makes sense that there is one, and understanding what happens when you get there is really interesting.
Yeah, it's like the speed of light for us, right? The closer you get to the speed of light, the more and more energy it takes to accelerate a little more to the point where you just fundamentally can't achieve that much energy.
Yeah.
So it's not like, you know, for practical reasons, we can't find enough dilithium or we don't have enough antimatter. It's like fundamentally, in principle, impossible to go faster than warp 10.
Until you find or even warp 10 in general. Dilithium's out.
Until they do the Voyager thing and make up a story.
Which remains stable at a higher warp frequency. There you go. I wrote that down.
We got to be careful. We're veering into non-defense territory. Yes. We're veering into criticism. We have to be careful.
We're not defending veering into criticism. I'm just saying, you know, you can't until you find a way to do it. That's the thing. It's not, oh, it's not possible. It's just, it's not possible yet.
With this new kind of dilithium.
Yeah, I think we just haven't found that dilithium. That's all.
Exactly. Like, I think the idea, like you were saying, of the fact that, you know, we hear him talk about this later on, about how he can see everything at once. That's an amazing concept to think about.
It's omniscience in the Q sense. Like, if you're literally everywhere simultaneously, you have this kind of God's eye perspective on everything. And Tom Paris now has that Q-like perspective.
So he can peek in on people's sonic showers? Is that what you're saying?
Potentially. The potential is there.
Okay.
The sonic shower is hot and the sheets are set.
Oh, Lord.
But yeah, it's good that we finally get to this conversation, you know, what happens when you get there. And it makes sense that we do that in Voyager. Because, you know, Voyager's looking for that way to get home faster. Voyager's looking for that kind of
how can
we travel more quickly? How can we get through a portal, wormhole, whatever, how could we kind of circumnavigate this long distance that we've got to do? You know, makes sense.
If only they had a spore drive.
They could have just gone like, let's go 9.99975 and gone really, really fast, but that's nowhere near as interesting as actually going warp 10 and being everywhere in the universe at once.
It's
just a cool Voyager idea. You know, that's a Voyager kind of concept.
Absolutely. And I mean, we're still, season two here. So we're still very much in that. They're still desperate to try and just get home. Just get home.
What do you think about Tom Paris's kind of desire to be in the history books? Like, he wants to be counted with Neil Armstrong and he wants to be counted with Zefram Cochrane. And he kind of is, right? He's the first guy to go warp 10. He did it.
Well, I think it has to do with how he feels his father views him. And this would definitely put him in a better light with his father. In his mind, it's to please Dad. Maybe Dad will love me now.
If you have to be up there with Neil Armstrong to please Dad, that's a tough act to follow.
Oh, no. Admiral Paris is a difficult man. If you've read Mosaic.
Thanks, Suzanne. Way to throw me under the bus.
That's what I do.
But yeah, no, absolutely. And I think we've really hit on, to be honest, what I think is the most interesting thing about this episode, which is, I know we get a lot of insight into Tom in sort of 30 days and episodes like that, but I actually think we get really deep into Tom's psyche here, and there's a lot to pull out from that. So I really think that's the real, real good stuff in this episode. You know, that he says a few things that really kind of make you think, wow.
Yeah.
Well, it's clear he doesn't feel good enough. He thinks everyone's ready to, like, put him off the ship, and he's, you know, waste of space and taking up, you know, waste of a uniform, more or less, right?
Yeah, well, exactly. And it's not just, you know, for anyone, if he'd gone through what he'd gone through, which is he'd made this mistake about what had happened with him when he was, you know, back in the day with his display team and what have you, when he's had this accident.
When he was Nick Locarno?
People have died. Yes, back when he was Nick Locarno. You know, that had happened to anyone who's been cashiered out of Starfleet and then he's ended up with the Marquis and getting arrested and all the rest of it. You know, that would be a hard thing to take for anyone when they think their life's going one direction and they end up going another direction. But when he already has this massive weight of expectation on him, which if you hear him talk in this episode, it's not just from his dad. Like, it is from his dad a lot. Mm-hmm. That is a big part of it. But he says at one point, oh, you know, everybody told me Tom Paris is going to do something special.
Yeah.
Everybody, my teachers, my friends, my, you know, peer group, my parents and my, you know, other adults in my life and everything, they've all said, oh, Tom Paris is going to do something special, you know. And I think, obviously, you know, he is quite gifted. He's really gifted, especially in piloting. Mm-hmm. He's got a lot of skill there. And to kind of have that weight of expectation lying on you must be massive. And yeah. You almost wonder whether he hasn't screwed up, because he's constantly trying to do that awesome thing. It's like when he was doing this display thing, is it like, oh, well, he wanted to be the first person to do this thing in X length of time, therefore he screwed up. So it was possibly even that drove him to do that in the first place.
I think you're onto something. Mm-hmm. I think it's too easy to blame Admiral Paris for all of Tom's psyche. A lot of this just comes from Tom.
Oh, definitely. It's self-imposed.
He feels like he's not good enough. And he sets a really high standard for himself, and he lets himself down a lot. And that doesn't have everything to do with his dad.
No, not at all.
I wasn't saying it has to do with his dad. He feels that it has to do with his dad. So he's doing it to himself thinking,
that's right.
This is what my father wants of me. Which a lot of kids end up doing to themselves. They're like, okay, my parents want me to do this, so I have to. And really, honestly, all you want from your kids is for them to be happy. Does it?
Yeah, you just want what's best for them, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But it is interesting, you know, where's that come from in Tom? You know, yeah, his dad's had expectations on him, but obviously, you know, there's something in him as well that builds that. He's ended up in a situation where he feels like he's got to do something amazing. Nothing he does is ever good enough, and he's got to try and push the envelope in order to come up with some amazing thing that everybody's expecting him to do.
Mm-hmm. I love that it also shows just how aware he is. You know, we kind of learn over Voyager's Run that Tom is a history buff, but he is aware of the great things that have been done in history, and he wants to be part of it, even though he's like just a flyboy, or he's just a screw up, right, when we first meet him. But really, he is aware of the trajectory of human history, and he wants to be a part of something great deep inside, I think.
Yeah. I think he just wants to be someone. I'm not even sure that it's... And I don't think it's particularly kind of big-headed. It's not a big-headed thing. It's just he feels... He needs to feel like he's good enough.
Deep down, don't we all want to be something special? Do something special?
Yeah.
Be noticed? Be in the history books? That's just a human feeling. Everybody wants that. Everybody wants to be noticed.
Leave a mark on history, you know. Everybody wants to feel like they've done that. But I think for some reason I get the impression with Tom that that's got warped somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, dovetailing on that a little bit is the fact that we get kind of a Tom Paris, Captain Janeway trust fall moment mm-hmm. as a result, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's an important little piece of the building of the trust between them as colleagues.
Yeah. I think their relationship is really interesting anyway.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, I always kind of wondered about the relationship that they had prior to this. Mm-hmm. I mean, she doesn't introduce herself to him when they meet, but I'm not convinced that, you know, if we actually think about it, it's particularly plausible that they haven't met before. Maybe when he was a kid, so maybe he wouldn't necessarily...
Oh, I'm sure they've met before. I mean, she was...
Yeah.
She worked with Admiral Paris.
But maybe Tom, was Tom on the ship? Was he back on the planet?
He was probably back on the planet, but still she'd see pictures of him. And probably, you know, when they visit Earth, saw him in passing, things like that.
She saw him when he was little thumb-sucking baby blanket-clinging Tom Paris?
Yes, absolutely. I'm sure she did. Especially as well, given the fact that her dad was an mm-hmm. admiral. as well. So the chances of them kind of associating it functions and things like that is quite high.
Oh, definitely.
With other families of admirals and stuff. And they might have even kind of seen each other for dinner and stuff like that. So I think it's totally plausible they would have met. Probably, maybe not so much as adults, but definitely she'd have known him as a kid, I would have thought.
It's like that scene in Generations when we meet Sulu's daughter. Like when Chekhov says, oh, you've met her before, but she was only this mm-hmm. big. You know, yeah. A similar conversation happened on Voyager. Oh, you've met Tom before, but he was only this big. It wouldn't be Voyager without a Paris at the helm.
Yeah. So possibly Tom doesn't really remember because he would have been a little Probably. Kid or whatever, but yeah.
She's like, oh, he's like, oh yeah, I recognized your hairstyle.
Or he does remember and secretly resents the attention that she got from his father.
From his dad. Yeah, maybe.
Mm.
It's interesting though, isn't it? Because he has a really interesting dynamic with her. You know, because she's taken him as one of her reclamation projects.
He might see her as a big sister at this point.
I think that's probably the most kind of sensible way to view the relationship in personal terms, yeah.
At least at the beginning of the episode, maybe not at the end.
That wasn't really in their control.
I like the fact that they kind of have a trust fall moment at the end of the episode. You know, they sit down on the bio beds and they're talking and you know, that's probably the first real conversation they've had together, actually.
Yeah, and I really like as well how we get this, again, as we've seen throughout Star Trek, we get this really kind of adult, no-nonsense, no-embarrassment mm-hmm. discussion about sex. Like, they're not bothered. They're not bothered, and I like that.
Oh,
we
yes.
get that throughout Star Trek, and it's something I really like in Star Trek. I really love that.
Yes, they've shed all the Victorian theories, and the way that Americans treat sex is very backwards in my mind.
And they're like the most unlikely pair on the ship, and Captain Janeway is like, well, I hadn't thought about it with you, honestly, but now that we've done it, you know.
But neither of them kind of cowers away from the conversation, and I love yeah. that. I think yeah. that's brilliant. And I love seeing that throughout the whole of Star Trek, that we have this kind of future where people have just gotten over that, where everybody's like, well, you know, sex is a thing we do, people enjoy yeah. it, it's a biological function, and why do we need to be embarrassed about it? Why do we need to get all het up about it?
Yeah, because if it didn't happen, you wouldn't be here.
Exactly, exactly. But there's just all this kind of weirdness around it that just, in Star Trek, just doesn't exist. And I love
that. And I love that.
It's great. Yeah, I really like
that. I wish we could have that in real life. I really do.
But I really do feel like, you know, we delve right into Tom's psyche here. And I know everybody thinks of 30 Days, which I mentioned a little bit before, as being the episode where we really sort of get into Tom's head. But I feel like, by comparison, that's quite lighthearted. There's something lighthearted about 30 Days. And he gets into the sort of letter with his dad, and there's just something quite gentle about it. It doesn't really delve into him in quite the same way as this does. I mean, there's some things that he comes out with here that just make you go, wow.
Well, he's not just in prison. He's literally being transformed and is dying for all intents and purposes. Yeah.
Well, in 30 Days, we see an older Tom. He's learned more about himself, more accepting of his past than we have in Threshold, where he's still very negative on himself as a person and his past and everything he's done.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a few lines that I really homed in on when I was watching this and that really made me kind of think about where he is at this point in his life. Because there's one line that he says, which is, what I remember most about being a kid is when I was in my room crying.
Mm-hmm.
Seriously, oh, like, wow. The one thing you remember most about being a kid is crying in your room. That is a mentally kind of unstable person who's feeling like that.
Nothing positive, like I remember going to see the Spaceball game with my dad, nothing like that. Right?
But then he also brings up his virginity, losing his virginity in that same room.
That is true.
That is one of the weirdest moments.
But I am.
With the Doctor and Kes there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And another good line from the Doctor, I'll note that in your medical file.
Because that's something that he needs to keep track of. This worries me about what data the Doctor is keeping on people.
Well, he needs that all for later for his holo novel.
That's true for the Hollow novel. But that she shouldn't be using medical files for that. That's confidential.
No, just change the names a little bit.
Exactly.
Just like we did, just like we did with Dennis
Alexiev. Oh, it's all right. Just call him Lieutenant Marseille. It'll be fine.
What kind of Hollow novel is the Doctor writing? Jeez.
Who knows? Hey, we only got to see the one, but maybe he's been talking to Barclay too much. But yeah, that one really kind of hit me. I was like, wow, he's got some stuff going on in there if that's what he thinks.
Yeah.
Well, he's at death's door, right? So he's kind of almost having like diarrhea of the mouth. Like it's just the stuff is starting to come out, stuff that wouldn't come up in a normal context.
I have not heard that in years.
You can always count on me for good colorful metaphors.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. But I think, you know, as well, yes, that is stuff that wouldn't normally come up. And I think in those sort of moments, that's when you get the truth out of people. That's when you see right down in there when you wouldn't normally, because he'd never normally tell people that. That's not something he would normally tell people. He wouldn't lay himself bare like that normally.
He does embarrass himself a little bit by asking Kes to kiss him.
But the Doctor thought he was asking him.
not you.
That was funny, I have to say. That would have been great. I would have loved that.
The Doctor been like, okay.
I'm the only one that can breathe the air. I'm the only one you're getting there, Tommy.
We'd have had the first gay kiss on Star Trek about 20 years earlier. That would have been great. Yeah. But I mean, this is around the time when he's kind of having his little bit of a possible thing going on with Kes, isn't it, anyway? So
yeah.
He's got a little crush at that point.
There's some stuff going on with them, isn't there? So I think that kind of... I'm not convinced he would have done that if it was anyone.
Well, not B'Elanna. He doesn't trust B'Elanna. She doesn't cry, right?
No, although we do really see B'Elanna. She's got some stuff going on there for Tom already. I actually thought, generally speaking, that all came a bit later than this. But she was really worried about him there, wasn't she?
She was.
So that kind of stood out to me a bit as well, that we saw the embryonic bit of that relationship starting to flourish there. Certainly from her side. He's oblivious to it, but...
Well, he's a man. They usually are.
Yeah. I have first-hand experience with this level of oblivion.
Apologize for your sex, Zachary.
No problem. Rubber stamp.
Yeah, so there was that. But also, actually, before he even gets to this point, you know, before we even have the test flight, he says something else as well to Janeway. Which is kind of circling back around to this Janeway relationship, which is when she's talking to about how, Harry's going to have to do the flight instead because you've got this imbalance in your whatever bit of your brain. Therefore, there's going to be this 2% risk or whatever of you having a brain hemorrhage, and we should get Harry to do it instead. And he's insisting that he wants to do it. And she's saying, oh, it's too much risk. They sort of have a bit of back and forth on it for a while, but he actually ends up saying, this is the first time in 10 years I feel like I have a life to risk.
Yeah.
That's a great line.
So again, that was an interesting line from him.
It also shows how invested he's become, right? He's not just, he's not phoning this one in. He's taking ownership over this project.
Yeah, he is. I think he does, because Janeway sees exactly what we see, because she says, I can't remember the exact line she says to him during that conversation, but she says something about, oh, this isn't your personal redemption or something like that. Because she realizes that he's seeing something along those lines. You know, he's seeing that this is an opportunity for him to redeem himself. But I do think there is more to it than that. I do think there's more to it. I don't think it is just that. I think it's partially that, but I think it's also, you know, he's ended up in this situation where he now feels like he's got the opportunities again to do something, which he didn't have for a long time. So I think there's a lot of that behind it as well.
It's easier to make a name for yourself on Voyager than it is in an Australian Federation penal colony.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting.
New Zealand? Australia. New Zealand.
Yeah.
Right?
New Zealand.
Well, something that's actually just struck me as well, interestingly, while we're talking now about this conversation that they have, is that obviously, you know, she's talking about him going down in the history books. Well, he'll only go down in the history books if they actually get back to the Alpha Quadrant.
Yeah.
And or they manage to make contact with Starfleet to be able to tell them about it. So I find that interesting because that's like a supreme level of confidence that they're going to make it home, isn't it?
Well, at this point, Captain Janeway did have that supreme level of confidence.
Yeah.
She's like, come hell or high water, we're making it back.
But can you imagine this terrible situation that would have occurred? Suppose Tom succeeds and he breaks the Warp 10 barrier and he makes history only to get back to the Alpha Quadrant and find out someone has already done it first over there.
Oh, that would be so awful.
What a disappointment.
Wow.
What a letdown.
Surely he would have seen them having done it, though, when he was everywhere at once.
That's right. Well, you don't travel back in time, right? You don't go back in time when you achieve Warp 10, right?
If he can see everything at once, presumably he can see inside Starfleet headquarters the one computer that's displaying the warp records.
Like the plaque because on the wall, already, like yeah, the award on, that someone won, right?
Yeah, so he'd know if somebody else had managed to do it first or not.
It's like, oh good, my name's not there yet.
Or a name's not there yet.
The look on his face as he sees that, he's like, damn.
Now I'm going to have to find something else.
I achieved Warp 10 and all I got was this lousy t-shirt.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, sorry, but actually, you were beaten to it, I'm afraid. So yeah, we get a lot of deep stuff from Tom, but I also feel like we get, by the end of the episode, we get the epiphany. Which is really nice because we delve into all this stuff, but by the end of it, he actually figures it out because, you know, he's told us about all this bad stuff that's happened to him. He said, oh, you know, does it matter that I'm like this? Because maybe what I'm becoming is going to be better than who I was, and how unhappy he is with himself.
It's going to go to his head, though. You know, every time Tom's in trouble, he's going to go, yeah, but I broke Warp 10. Oh, that old chestnut again?
Well, no, I don't think he is, because I feel like the quote that we get from him at the end here actually, to me, feels a bit like how he starts on the road to who we see him become. Because he actually says, after talking to Janeway about how, oh, you know, he spent all his life trying to impress everybody and trying mm-hmm. to live up to this thing that everybody's expected to him, he actually says, oh, well, I've realized that it's not other people's minds that I have to change.
It's his own. It's his, yeah.
And when he said that, I was like, yes, he gets it. He's yeah. just got to believe himself that he's good enough. And it's not about trying to impress everybody else or trying to live up to everybody else's expectations. And that, to me, I think is probably the most important thing to take from this episode. You know, if people are skipping this in a rewatch, I'm like, that is a lot of growth for Tom right there.
Yeah.
That's a point where he now has a springboard over which we see him grow into this like responsible husband, responsible father that we see later on, that he goes through that, and that feels like a beginning of that. So I really like the fact that he gets to that by the end of the episode.
I don't want to see Tom's midlife crisis, though. You know, when he when he hits age 40, he's like, God, I really want to like buy a convertible and go Warp 10.
No, but we did see Tom's midlife crisis with Alice.
Oh yeah, we did Alice, see it in Alice.
That's totally true.
When he gets the sporty little car, as it were.
He's got Alice and going Warp 10 again with his hair on fire. One of the things I loved about this episode, and it's just a little thing, but I love Neelix's Wesley Crusher saves the day moment. Like, no one thinks Neelix is smart enough to come up to understand the warp theory, and he totally comes up with the idea that makes the whole thing possible.
Yeah, Neelix needs a bit of credit for that, to be fair. Because he doesn't really appear in the episode other than that, but he basically is the one.
It's like in baseball, when you win an award but you've been doing steroids, he gets a little asterisk by his name. Tom and Neelix, with an asterisk.
But Neelix does get mentioned. Well, at least his coffee does.
That's true.
The Tom Paris coffee? The Paris
blend? Yeah, because that's the first indication he gets that something weird's going on, isn't it? When B'Elanna's like, oh, the coffee tastes all right, yeah.
Well, the doctor asks, what did Tom ingest? And B'Elanna's like, just Neelix's coffee. And the doctor says, well, it's a miracle he's still alive.
Yeah.
The Which is how coffee, I feel about substitute. Neelix's coffee, too. Because, yeah, whenever you see it poured, it's, oh, how do you choke that down? Unless it's like chocolate sauce.
They've just gotten used to it. That's the thing.
Because that's what the consistency looks like is chocolate sauce.
It does, yeah. Yeah.
It's got viscosity.
I just always imagine when they get back to Earth and they get to eat like proper food again, they're going to be like, oh my God. Because they got used more Leola to like, root. Food.
You know you've got to work on your coffee recipe when they give it a viscosity rating.
they've just gotten like a taste for really bad food, and then they get back to Earth and like, what is this rubbish? I want some Leola root. That fanfic needs to exist.
Oh, that would be great.
Neelix's coffee probably has some great secondary engineering applications as a lubricant.
They probably use it in engineering. I'm sure they do. Like, rub it on some gears or whatever.
How exactly do you store data based on everything in the universe? He comes back with, what, 5 billion gigaquads or something like that? And that's just from one sector alone, if memory serves?
Yeah. Yeah, it was just they were just looking at the sector, weren't they? But I don't know how much he'd actually brought, whether it was, like, everything.
Well, it couldn't be everything because it's an infinite amount of data, right?
So he'd spend a lot of time typing up reports after that.
That's a long night of report writing.
I meant everything in terms of, like, the star charts and stuff.
That's still a lot of information and a lot of hours to just spend writing it down and typing it into the computer. And
I actually, again, this is kind of a little thing, but I actually kind of like the little rotating Okudagrams with all the different star charts and planets and stuff that he'd seen. That was fun.
Yeah. Yeah, we get some quite cool displays there. I mean, it is totally plausible that he'd come back with a lot of data, but like you say, how do you render that into...
And how does it decide what gets recorded and what doesn't? Like, how does the computer know?
The computer can only record so much. I mean, how much is in Tom's head that the computer didn't catch? And that's why I'm like, he's going to spend hours just writing reports about what he saw.
Well, yeah, because it's only going to be able to do it at, like, the right speed of whatever storage they've got in the shuttle computer.
So if he's at a certain point in space in the Delta Quadrant and he pushes the magic button that makes Warp 10 happen, does the data kind of get recorded in concentric circles? Like, it starts recording data, like, where he's at that moment, and then at a certain point it maxes out and there's no data from anywhere else in the universe? Like, how does this work?
I don't know.
Inquiring minds want to know, Kay.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the Spore Drive.
You just like to mention the Spore Drive.
No, but I mean, remember Stamets was like, I was here and I was there, and that's what I think of, because Tom mentions that he was everywhere. He was with Kazon, he was back home, the Klingons, other galaxies. So it's kind of Spore Drive-esque without being, you know, USB hooked in.
Yeah.
But Tom can't take 133 different micro warp 10 trips.
Neither could Stamets, actually. That poor guy.
Yeah, he looked a bit not so good afterwards. It was the last one that did it.
Yeah.
Inevitably. But I do see what you're saying. There are parallels there.
I can't wait for January.
Yeah, me neither.
And side note, that's the day after my birthday. Thank you for the late birthday present, Star Trek.
Yay!
So presumably there's some sort of explanation in the universe that we don't get, but this is me and my inquiring mind wants to know.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I mean, it did start from... They did say it was mainly the sector they were in, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
I think so.
Yeah, so maybe that was the point it got to before it just ran out of space or ran out of the ability to write the information any quicker before he came out of it. And I guess that's the most important information they would want anyway, because that's where they are.
Yeah, it helps.
Think of how that would transform the Federation and Starfleet's mission, right? You could explore at Warp 10 without having to actually go anywhere. Just hit the button, boom, you're everywhere, get the knowledge, and you're done.
Yeah. I do find it kind of interesting that they stop trying to do it after this, though, because once the Doctor's figured out how to switch them back, can't they just do it again and then switch them back quick?
It's kind of like an infinite knowledge button, like an omniscience button. Hit the button, boom, now you know everything.
Yeah, it would be very transformative if it was something that they managed to harness, but obviously there are side effects.
Good science.
Very much like the Spore Drive.
Yeah.
There are side effects. That's really interesting, actually, Suzanne, because I hadn't even really thought about the parallels there until you mentioned it, but it is quite nice that we can pull that parallel with the new series.
It definitely hit me when I watched it at the beginning of this week. I was like, whoa, wait a minute. Spore Drive. Yeah.
So this, I have to admittedly say that the Spore Drive bugs me a bit. I'm like, this is a ridiculous concept. I don't understand this. I don't like it. It
doesn't fit with my vision of
how the Star Trek universe works. I love mushrooms, but I don't like the Spore Drive.
Don't be hating on the mushrooms. And don't ever hate on my tardigrade.
But this special dilithium that causes Tom to go warp 10 is just as wacky doodle of an idea. And that doesn't bother me so much. And I find that one interesting, but I don't really care for the Spore Drive. What is the difference?
I'm cool with mad science. Like, I am totally down with the idea of pushing the envelope of like what this actually means. Because obviously we have our current knowledge of science as a base, mm-hmm. and kind of we know that Star Trek's always been based off of actual science. It's never been hard science in the way that I think some people think that it is. It's always kind of really just taken current science and pushed it beyond what we know and tried to kind of maybe extrapolate where it's going with a bit of imagination thrown in. But I do like it when they go, well, we don't really know where we're going to end up science-wise, and we don't really know what happens when you get to that point. So they just come up with an interpretation, and it's based in theory that exists, but they sort of push it because we just don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not finding it terribly plausible that they're going to end up in magic mushroom science in the future, but...
I think there's magic mushroom science.
Well, I would just like to see the giant tardigrade. Yeah. Doesn't everybody want a cute, cuddly water bear of their own?
I want a plushy tardigrade.
And I super so cute want one. A plush.
There's a super, super cute one you can get from, like, Think Geek, but the cost of, like, importing it is ridiculous. But they are very cute. Super cute. They do, like, mini ones and big ones. So I guess we are digressing slightly into like a little bit of talk about Discovery, but I think that's okay because we've been very good and we haven't talked about it too much yet.
No, yeah. No one ever seems to want a plushie of the lizard that Tom turns into. So.
With removable tongue.
For some reason.
It would have to have the removable tongue.
Yeah, life-sized. No, yeah.
Props to the makeup department on this episode.
Yes. Yeah, I think we've they talked a little bit before above about and the beyond. Makeup on this episode, yeah. Haven't we? I think they won an Emmy, didn't they, for makeup for this episode? Yes, and deservedly did. So, because given how long ago this is, it's pretty impressive.
But this does feel a lot like the kind of thing that should happen to Harry Kim instead of Tom Paris.
But everything bad happens to Harry. You gotta That's give him saying. A break once in a while.
Janeway tried to throw him under the bus there, didn't she?
But then if it was Harry, he would have died.
Yeah, and then been brought back to life. Or we'd have got an alternate version of him.
So what do you think, guys? Have we successfully defended Threshold?
I think we found stuff to like in here.
Yeah, we've found some good points.
And I definitely think if you're looking for picking out episodes that really typify Tom's development as a character, you can't really leave this one out. I think it's a really key episode for him.
Definitely. So. Well, it's been fun defending the indefensible Threshold today, but this isn't the only thing we've been discussing on the network. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, the 602 Club.
I know, I went all in. Yeah, I think if it came up short, I think there was going to be a lot of screen caps with a lot of people. I think even on podcasts, I've been throwing it all out. Oh, this is going to be one of the best. Trust me on this one. Yeah, Thor 2, ignore that. This one will be the bee's knees, as it were. So, yeah, there was a lot of pressure. Right? I don't think just on Marvel and Taiki Waititi, but on me, myself, with my audacious claims.
The Edge, a Star Trek Discovery podcast.
And with the final argument that he has with Burnham at the end of the episode, right, everywhere that Burnham is, she's taking away from him, and that's how he feels, right? We as the audience see it differently, but according to Saru, Burnham is always taking, and destroying Saru's life by taking all this stuff.
Meta Treks.
But it was 1977 that Kunzel went off and started recording with the Cincinnati Pops. And basically the Cincinnati Pops and Eric Kunzel saved the Telarc record label back in the 80s when they recorded the 1812 Overture. And that was such a huge record, and classical records weren't doing so well back in the early 80s.
Standard Orbit.
I wonder how they combined the matter of the two of them. Is there a setting where it's just like combined or not combined?
You know, obviously, obviously. It's that little blinking blue button that's kind of shaped like a warped Skittle on the right side that does that.
Oh, God. I'll look for that in those close-ups of not James Doohan's hands next time I watch the episode.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or even the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they are published. And please leave us a star rating and written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, in most third-party apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link.
Well, as always, we would love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are lots of different ways for you to send them to us. The best place to join in the larger conversation is in the Babel Conference, which is our listeners group on Facebook. If you just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. If you choose Message to a Trek FM Show and select To the Journey, that will come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. So, Suzanne, when you're not crying in your bedroom, where can our listeners find you?
Well, you can find me popping in the Babel Conference every now and then. You can also find me on Twitter. My handle is KJaneWay8. Zach, when you're not talking to the doctor about the time you lost your virginity, where can our listeners find you?
It's classified. Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of MetaTrek's Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy, along with my co-host over there, Mike Morrison. You can always find me in the Babel Conference if you'd like to talk about Voyager with me over there, and you're welcome to follow me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Kay, how about you? When you're not trying to write yourself into the history books with Neil Armstrong, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, you can always find me in the Babel Conference. And if you want to look me up on Twitter, my handle is ChocoWeeble.
Well, one of the best ways you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network through Patreon. Just visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and many more, all available through our special patrons website, the Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of time and money to produce, host, and distribute these podcasts each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm.
Well, we have some people that we'd like to thank. The real first man to break the Warp 10 barrier, our founder and publisher, C. Brian Jones. Our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp. Aaron Harvey, our art director. Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Brandon Shea Matala, our Patreon manager.
Now, Chris doesn't just break the Warp 10 barrier, he does it with his hair on fire.
That's true. That is very true. And he looks classy while he's doing it as well.
Very always, dapper. Always.
Of course, we also want to give a really big shout out to our associate producers. Bruce Lish, Ju Kim, Richard Marquez, Patrick Carlin, and Norman Lau. Thank you very much, as always, for your support of To The Journey and of Trek FM.
Join us next time when we will be everywhere at once. But until then, this has been To The Journey.